Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. For over 30 years, Merrick has crafted high-quality dog food. Since our founding in Hereford, Texas, all of Merrick's recipes have prioritized whole nutrition with deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. That's why we say real is our recipe. Real ingredients and homestyle flavors your pet loves. Look for new Merrick packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. Find it online or in your local pet store.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Welcome to the New Books Network. Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and sometimes I get to step back behind the microphone, and I always like to do this, especially when I can talk to a fellow podcasting entrepreneur, if I can use that word. Today, we're talking to Sean Guillory, who is the host of the SRB podcast, a podcast that focuses on Russian affairs. I highly recommend it. We'll put a link in the show notes so you can go and subscribe. Sean has done a whole bunch of things, the most impressive of which is he has actually founded and runs a successful academic podcast. That's a hard thing to do, let me tell you. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Marshall. I'm impressed by your ability to rattle off that introduction like that. I could never do this kind of stuff.
I haven't figured it out yet. Yeah, rattling is one of my skills. You can't really put that on your CV, but I can rattle. Yeah. So maybe you could begin just by, and this is before the question in which I ask you about your podcast.
Sure.
Just tell us about you.
About
who's
me.
Sean? Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, let's see. I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I have a PhD in Russian history from UCLA. And, you know, Marshall, I don't need to regale you with the pitfalls of academic life, but not getting a job in a tenure track job, which actually now I'm blessed to not have one. I have to say, you know, at the time it was horrible, but now in retrospect, it's like the best thing that ever happened to me. But at any rate, so I started a blog in 2005, actually, called Sean's Russia Blog. As you can tell, I didn't put much time in the naming because I didn't think it would go anywhere. But after a couple of years of just kind of writing about, you know, Russian affairs, I started to have an audience. So the blog kept going and going and going. And then once I kind of crash landed with academia, I decided to start my own podcast called the SRB Podcast in 2015. So nowadays, most of my time is dealing exclusively with audio. I'm actually not so interested in writing, certainly not academic writing, but I've been more and more fascinated and involved in how to translate, you know, a lot of the ideas that the New Books Network propagates in terms of scholarship, how to translate those academic ideas into good stories, and try to get even some colleagues, some scholars, to think about how to approach their material in a different way and promote audio as a different medium of intellectual engagement. So this is my focus now. I'm moving into more narrative audio. I'm really interested in this. As you mentioned, I have this documentary, Teddy Goes to USSR, which comes out May 30th. And then I'm working on, I'm working on a new documentary after that, that I've been actually researching for the last couple of years, on a guy named Levitt Fort Whiteman, who is the only African-American we know of who is a victim of Stalin's terror. So I'm doing a multi-part documentary based on archival research from Russia, Kazakhstan, the United States, of African Americans, the Soviet Union, and communism in the 20s and 30s, told through his life.
Wow, that sounds interesting. I have not heard of this fellow.
Yeah, so it's that. That's actually the big, the thing I've been wanting to do. But the Teddy Rowe thing, which I can talk about later, the Teddy Rowe project kind of fell in my lap, and then I got money for it. So then I had to go through with it. You know how that is,
right?
But all the while I've been doing research on for the second project, which is kind of more of my labor of love, but. Yeah, so that's a bit about me, unless you have any other specific questions.
No, I wanted to talk about the SRB podcast. Yeah. What first moved you to decide to do a podcast? I mean, this is for an academic, as I think most people would know. This is a very unusual thing to do. There are academic podcasts, and there are very good ones. You can find some of them on the New Books Network if you go to Academic Partners. But it was an unusual choice. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, I mean, to be completely honest, Marshall, a lot of it has to do with you.
Oh, really? How's that?
Well, for some, I don't know if you remember, but I guess it was a turning point in my life. But way back, I think it was in 2010.
Yes,
you,
I remember.
You reached out to me to join the New Books Network for its Eurasia channel. And I started doing it then, actually.
Yeah, I remember.
And then I kind of slinked away and got involved in other things. And then I've always had an interest in radio, I should say. In the 1990s, I became fascinated with this whole, like, trying to start your own radio station, like pirate radio type stuff. And then I did a few things at the Pacifica station in Los Angeles at the time on KPFK. So I've always had that interest. But it was really you who provided the opportunity for me to start doing this and then learning from it, because, you know, I didn't know anything in terms of the technical side, issues of production, even interviewing, these kinds of things. You know, everything I've done for the SRB podcast and the documentaries I'm working on is basically I've learned on my own or taken, you know, classes or something like this. So a lot of it has to do with you. And then when I, you know, needed to find some kind of life after academia, and not knowing what I want to do when I grow up, I decided, well, I have this, you know, website that's been around, this blog forever. So why don't I just start my own podcast?
Yeah, when you find out what you want to do with your life, could you please tell me, because I need some guidance there.
Well,
I just turned 60, and people ask me what I do, and I always say, I'll tell you when I figure it out.
Right. Well, you know, hey, you know, the problem is actually for me not figuring out what I want to do with my life, but actually sticking with something and not moving on to the next thing I want to do with my life.
That is a problem. Yeah, that is a problem. But I wanted to talk a little bit about, I should say also by way of a small digression, you're not the only host on the NBN who has gone on to start a successful podcast. And I'm always very happy when this happens. You know, some people say, oh, Marshall, I'm going to leave because I'm going to start my own podcast about cricket, to give the most recent example. And I'm like, great, what could I do to help?
Yeah. No, it's very generous of you. I mean, it is. And to give people the space to develop if they're interested, right?
Well, I can say this in the way of not a humble brag, just a brag. I believe I have taught more people to podcast than any person alive. and hundreds of people have learned how to podcast as hosts on the NBN.
Well, I have to say, as somebody like myself who's actually really interested in the podcasting community, such that it is, like, I've taken classes from people who've worked at NPR forever. I've gone to like a week long documentary course at Duke University. You know, I think people like yourself actually have a lot to give to even that community, the podcasting community in general, in terms of like your experience.
I'm always very happy to talk about it if anybody wants to have me talk about it. And I do sometimes, go through my experience with the NBA, which kind of leads me to my next question. In setting up the SRB podcast, what sort of challenges did you face? Go ahead.
I think the first challenge actually was just on the technical side, to know how to record a good interview, how to edit a good interview. At first, you know, one of the turning points in starting was I did a survey of listeners way back several years ago. And one of the main complaints was the sound quality.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, I started to put a lot of investment into getting good sound quality.
Well, you sound great.
Well, I better, with this microphone, I better sound great. But it was also about not just, you know, learning like what's the good equipment, how to set it up, where to record, where not to record. It was also just, you know, what do you need to be aware of in terms of doing a good interview or recording a good interview in terms of like sound, like environmental sound or the dog barking? And then also on the editing side, I started, like most people, editing audio on Audacity. And it was only when I, you know, decided to shell out some money and, you know, get like a Adobe Audition.
That's what I use now.
Yeah. And so that also makes the world a whole different world. It's a whole different world when you're editing audio with that, as opposed to some other program. I mean, I'm not going to get into those technical details, but that was the first challenge. The second challenge, and this, I think this was something I didn't realize for a while, you know, coming from an academic background, what you're interested in isn't necessarily what listeners are going to be interested in. And I was shooting for an audience of, the way I imagine my audience is someone who isn't necessarily connected professionally to Russia, Eurasia, whatever, or to academia, but is interested. So they may not be like, you know the ins and outs of Russian history or even care, but they're interested in the region, or they're interested in the country for whatever reason. And when I've done surveys about like, you know, what's my audience, I found that about over half are just these kinds of people who don't have professional, who aren't the usual suspects, as I call them. So that was the other challenging thing, is to how to conduct an interview that wasn't like, you know, I was in a grad seminar dissecting the historiography of X, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, to ask more general questions, to even ask questions that I already knew answers to, but kind of playing that character of not knowing.
It's funny you mentioned that, because when I do interviews, especially if it's on a subject that I know a lot about, because I just read a book about it, the book in question, sometimes I will say to the interviewee, I'm going to ask questions that make it sound like I don't know anything about your book.
Yeah.
Don't think I don't, though, but it will sound like I don't, because I'm standing in for the person that has no idea.
Yeah. And this is one of the main lessons in why I try to encourage audio as a medium in general to get academics to think about, is you are forced, if you want to do it well, you're forced to consider audience, right? And you also have to decenter yourself. I mean, doing an interview, it's not about me as the interviewer. It's about the interviewee. So you have to also, you know, you can't approach the interview, at least in my opinion, as a platform for yourself, right? You have to some extent, erase yourself. Or, like I said, you could play a character of sorts, which is kind of a combination of what I do.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%. In fact, if you get the we have, you know, onboarding materials for hosts on the NBN, and one of the bits of advice that I give people is just to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Because really, at least on the NBN, what people want is to hear from the author, the researcher, the specialist, and not the host. And so we go to pretty great pains to make sure that on our interviews, the author does over 90% of the talking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it should be, because the purpose of an NBN interview is to allow the author to talk about what they found in their research. Full stop, no explanation needed. That's it.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I really try to emphasize this. They're not platforms for opinionating and bloviating and all the other stuff that people do. And I think the listeners appreciate that. We get right to it. It's about the book. It's about the book. So, the technical hurdles, though, they've gotten lower.
Oh,
I think
you
can agree on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's gotten so much better. As I was saying in the pre-interview, when we were chatting beforehand, when I started 15 years ago, I used to use Skype out to call people on cell phones.
Yeah.
Now, it's just much, much better. It's much easier.
Now nobody even uses Skype.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's funny, because sometimes I will, sometimes just to mess with people, I will say, I'm going to call you on Skype. And they're like, what's Skype?
Exactly. It's a good way to date yourself. That's for sure.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it's funny. It really is. If you could receive an email from me, it will have a Skype address. I wonder if people will like, I just left it in there. I don't know why. I was like, what is that Skype?
Right.
But yeah, now, I mean, and especially in the age of Zoom, now everybody knows how to do something like we're doing. And that's been a great boon for us.
Yeah, it has. There's the learning curve for guests to manage this technology has gone down considerably because of COVID.
It really has. And people aren't frightened of it anymore. And you know, they're, you know, good audio in, good audio out. I always tell people you can make good audio better, but you can't make bad audio good. It's just
that's
not
true.
There is no studio magic. It does not
exist. There's another thing about COVID that actually is interesting because of COVID, it's actually brought the quality of professional podcasting and radio down.
Really? Talk about that.
Well, so for example, you know, most like let's say take Fresh Air, you know, very famous NPR, Terry Gross. Everybody knows Terry Gross. Well, all of those interviews are done remotely or they're done in studio. And when they're done remotely, a lot of times somebody is at a local radio station or at a university, whatever studio. But now during COVID, you couldn't do that.
You're so right about this.
And so because of years of doing this, I can tell when I hear.
I know just what you mean. Let me give you an example. Like when I hear one of these interviews now, I can tell that the person is using what I call a dangling mic.
Yes.
They always have a little click. There's a little click that they produce when they move. I can always tell, that person's wearing a dangling mic from an iPad or iPod or whatever they are. Yeah.
So it actually has brought the quality down because even professionals now are using Zoom. They're not able to use tape syncers, which is the 90% of, you know, basically hiring somebody to sit with a microphone while you interview somebody over the internet or the phone or whatever. So when you couldn't do that, they had to adjust. I mean, some people, I was listening to, I think it was New York Times' daily podcast. This is way in the beginning of the pandemic, where the host was talking about recording in his closet. And I was like, wow, you're like, you know, a DIY podcaster now.
Yeah.
Welcome to our world.
Yeah, that's right.
But the technical hurdles are, you know, far less than they were when I started.
Yeah. I mean, also in terms of hosting, though, I mean, when I started podcasting 15 years ago, I hosted my own files. I remember I had a Bluehost account.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And for $15 a month or whatever it was, and I would serve my own files from the Bluehost account. And this involved a lot of stuff that I don't have to do anymore. And now there are pretty good podcast hosts out there. Like we're on Megaphone, and there are a bunch of others that will do this for you at a pretty reasonable price.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the resources, I mean, there is a reason why there are 2 million podcasts out there.
Yeah, that's right.
And why you see so many services and why you now see our, you know, attempts at corporate capture with Spotify and everybody's trying to get into the, you know, the podcasting business.
Yeah. I mean, in a way that corporate capture has been good for us. I'm not sure it's been good for small independent podcasters because in a way, you know, the creation of companies like Megaphone, and there are others, Libsyn and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Blueberry is another one. I admire the guy, Todd Cochran, who founded that. They have found a way to monetize podcasts, which really sort of saved our bacon because it was very hard to keep doing what we were doing. And our mission is public education, full stop. But even a company whose mission is public education needs revenue to continue. And so we have kind of benefited from the entrepreneurial, spirit that these people brought to podcasting.
Mm-hmm. They recognized early on, for sure.
Yeah, that we were reaching valuable audiences. And, you know, say what you will about advertising, good, bad, I don't know. It's one mechanism that allows us to keep doing what we're doing, that is pursue the mission, which is public education.
Right.
I mean, if in my ideal world, there'd be no ads. Sure, I get that. But we don't live in that world.
No, we don't. And so in terms of like what the hurdles are now, I mean, it goes to directly what you're saying is okay, how do you get an audience?
Yeah.
How do you maintain that audience? Well, you know, I on one hand, I don't have an answer for you. But what I do tell people who, especially if you're starting out a podcast, there's a couple of, you know, important things. The first one I tell them is consistency.
Yeah.
You know, if you decide, it doesn't matter how often you're going to put out a podcast, whether it's every week or every month or whatever, you just need to stick with one schedule. Because, you know, people who like it will subscribe and follow it. And then if they really like it, then they'll start expecting, you know, it to come out. And the worst thing could happen is that you go silent for 4 weeks or whatever, your weekly podcast, and then somebody unsubscribes because they're like, you know, podcasts fold all the time. Yeah. So
there's a lot of churn, of churn in podcasting.
There's consistency is a big issue. But at the same time, you know, like for an audience like mine who is interested in, you know, Eurasia or Russia or whatever. I mean, I understand that it's a finite audience. I'm not going to have an audience of millions or even tens of thousands.
Yep.
So, you know, and the thing with podcasting, it is a very niche thing, right? When you do a podcast, you want to be able to find your niche and cater to that.
Yep.
And so I think that is one way to deal with an audience. And of course, you know, social media, word of mouth, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I'm personally actually surprised when I meet people who know. It's like, oh, I listen to you all the time. I'm like, what?
Yeah. That's great.
So, you know, I think I've been, you know, of course I'd love to be bigger, but at the same time, you know, as they said in the 90s, more money, more problems. So I don't know if I want to be too big.
You got to manage expectations. I mean, doing the kind of things that we do in the academic space, you're not going to have huge hits, and nor do we even try to do that.
Right.
Because our mission, as I said, is really public education, and we try to cover as much as we possibly can. For an example, you know, we measure the success of the New Books Network by the number of episodes we publish.
Uh-huh.
Not the number of people who listen, not the amount of revenue that comes in, nothing else.
Wow.
It's just that. We try to publish as many episodes as we can because we're building a kind of library, a permanent repository of audio knowledge. And you know, do we do things to optimize it, you know, for revenue? No, we actually don't. we don't do that. No, we don't do anything like that. We sacrifice everything just to get the word out about these books.
Mm-hmm.
To go back to what you said about consistency, I have this phrase that I just tell everybody I talk to about building a podcast audience. And it is this. I should have t-shirts made up. You have to produce good content regularly over a long period of time. That's it.
Those three things.
Good content regularly over a long period of time, and people will find you.
Yeah. The hardest challenge for me presently is not getting burnt out. Because doing an interview show isn't it's not a great creative outlet because it's mostly about the guest, right?
Yep.
So the reason why I've moved more and more into narrative stuff is A, I find it more interesting. Like as a listener, I find it more interesting. But as a creator, it allows me to craft a story. It allows me to, you know, do things like add music or write narrative or, you know, all of these other components to audio production that are far more fun. At least I find far more fun than doing the straight interview show.
Well, and in fairness to you and to all the other narrative podcast creators out there, they actually take a lot of skills.
Oh, it takes a lot of time too.
An interview podcast is a very simple beast if you do it right. But an actual narrative podcast, that is something that I would not take on lightly.
Really?
No, it really does involve so many skills because, you know, you're like making a little documentary.
Yeah,
like,
that's
what it is. And that is hard. With a capital H. And,
I can tell you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. You have ventured into the narrative space with Teddy Goes to the USSR. Can you, who's Teddy?
So Teddy Rowe is this guy who lives in Billings, Montana. He's 80. Let's see. He was born in 1934. So I'm bad at math, but he's old.
Yeah, right.
and he spent his career actually working in Congress as a staffer for Mike Mansfield, who was the Democratic majority leader in the 60s and 70s, early 70s. And then Lee Metcalf after him in Mont. So both he's a diehard Montanan, Teddy is. And so the way why he's important, because he's just this guy. In late 2019, I got an email from a Ukrainian journalist and historian named Edward Andrushenko. Edward lives in Kiev. Thankfully, he's safe.
That's good.
From the war. But Edward has spent a lot of his time combing through the Ukrainian KGB archive. And he runs a very wonderful Telegram and YouTube channel called KGB Files, where he does videos and posts about the various weird things he finds in the KGB archives. And one of the things he found was a KGB report about an American tourist, this guy, Teddy Rowe. And Edward, as a listener of the SRB podcast, was interested in maybe working together if this guy's still alive. And initially the project was very, small. Edward wanted to write an article as a journalist, which he did way before I was even close to working on this. But we happened to find Teddy, that he was still alive. And as a result of that, I decided to basically fly out to Billings for a weekend and interview him over 3 days, and then take the interview. And the reason why he's important is there's this KGB report about him that was found 50 years after he was in the Soviet Union. And he went to Soviet Union in 1968 for 3 months as a tourist. And he went to every Soviet republic, which is for an American, a tourist, for a tourist, 3 months is a long time. Yep. It's unique. And to go to every Soviet republic is incredibly unique because, as you know, most of us only conceptualize the Soviet Union / Russia, whatever you want to call it, as Moscow or the central cities. We don't think about the republics.
No, we don't.
So it's an incredibly unique experience. And from interviewing him, basically the documentary is looking at this issue of, here's this American guy going around the Soviet Union, 1968, which is a tumultuous year in many respects, around the world.
Yep.
How he understands and views Soviet society, the tropes he uses to understand Soviet society that are based a lot in the Cold War. And how he navigates that space and how others, Soviet people, react to him.
Yeah.
And as a result, each episode there are 6 episodes. There's 5 episodes of content, which is dealing with issues of, what is it like to be a tourist in the Soviet Union? What's the experience like? What is this KGB file? What is the surveillance of tourists? Like, why did they do this? How did it actually work? A lot of the way Teddy, as a lot of Americans did during the Cold War, evaluated the Soviet Union through consumerism, right? What can Soviet people buy? How much can they buy? What are they consuming?
Yeah.
Unlike, like America, we're a place of bounty.
Yeah.
And how consumerism was a Cold War issue, the standard of living race. The next episode deals with race, because one of the things that Teddy gets asked constantly is, what's up with you Americans? Why are you still lynching black people? Which is a legitimate question.
Yeah, that is a totally legitimate question.
Even though it was a Cold
question.
War question, right? Yeah. It was, we tell jokes about, and there's Soviet jokes too about this, like, well, you lynch blacks kind of thing, right?
But I remember seeing posters of Angela Davis.
Yeah, of course.
Uh-huh. In Russia in the 80s. So right. Yeah, it was an issue.
So the issue that this episode, which is by far my favorite episode, the one on race, it's about like, what is up with this? Like, what is up with these questions? On the one hand, yeah, we can say it's propaganda, but is there something more going on? And how did the Soviet Union or Soviet people understand the civil rights movement in the United States?
Uh-huh.
So a lot of it is a lot of that episode is about like, what is this Soviet anti-racism all about, and how, is it all propaganda? Is there something else to it? How do we make sense of it?
Yeah.
It's various contradictions. The last episode is about episode 5 is about just daily life. Like, how did Soviet people live? What was going to work like? And the people Teddy met and his interactions with them, actually meeting people. He met this one couple at an opera in Kiev. They invited him to, their apartment. They took him around the city. He hung out with them. And so he had these really intimate relationships at certain points in his trip that are worth kind of, looking at and to get a sense of like, well, what did people, how did they live their daily lives?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the last episode will just be a kind of a wrap up discussion between me and a historian friend of mine, Leah Goldman, just kind of, you know, giving listeners like, okay, you've just listened to 5 hours of this guy's trip. You know, what do you, what are some things to walk away with, you know, to keep in mind?
Well, we won't do any spoilers here, so you don't need to tell us.
But... well, I'm still trying to figure out those myself. But and I should also say that the documentary has a website that has a bunch of other materials.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, so you know, it has, and I'm hoping that the whole point of it is for two things. One, I want people who are interested in the period in Soviet Union, et cetera, U.S.-Russia relations, to, you know, hear a good story, to hear some interesting things. But also hopefully, you know, on the educational side, maybe people will use this in their classroom.
Yeah.
And the website will act as a supplementary to, you know, like there's a KGB report and a translation of it. Just yesterday I translated a really good article on SNCC that was published in the Soviet press.
Huh. That must have been amazing.
It's you know, just to like look at like, well, what are they writing about this?
Yeah.
So that's in a nutshell the Teddy Goes to the USSR.
I have to ask, and again, I don't want to give any spoilers. What is the KGB file of his various peregrinations like?
It's short. It's about 3 pages, but it has a big supplementary. Essentially what they were doing, and he knew it at the time. This is what's really funny. They went into his – so we only have the report that was done by the Kievan – the Ukrainian police, right? Because we don't – the archives of Russia just aren't open, and they're never going to open. It's basically like they suspect him as being a spy. They suspect him as spreading his Americanness around. They broke into because they're interested in him because he's a staff member of the Democratic Majority Leader, right?
They think he's Politruk.
They think he's a window and they can learn something from him. Maybe they can cultivate him. I don't know. But it basically what they were doing is they went into his hotel room and broke into his luggage. And he was keeping – he has a 400 – that's the other thing I forgot to mention is that when I contacted Teddy, he has a 400-page diary.
Oh, wow.
That he kept of his trip.
That is just
gold. And like I don't know how many – couple hundred photographs.
Yeah.
And so – which I have a copy of the diary. And they took photographs of the diary. So the KGB report has translated passages from his diary. So there's nothing really explosive in it, but it does give you a sense of like, you know, why, you know, what did they think this guy is doing?
Yeah.
And whatever he's doing, he's probably up to no good.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating case because you get to see the same thing from two perspectives. One is the kind of the KGB perspective or the Russian perspective, looking at this strange American who they probably think is some sort of party apparatchik
you know,
sent to take pictures of I don't know what. And then you get to look at it from Teddy's perspective, going to this very strange place that he, you know, he probably knew a lot about it.
Because he has a master's degree.
You know, I mean, he knew, but he gets to see it firsthand.
But the one thing that's funny about this whole thing of them monitoring him, and this is a good spoiler because it's a good hook to listen to the documentary. He left a string, right, to see that was disturbed. He knew somebody was going through his stuff.
Yeah.
And then he left them a note saying, you know, if you want to know something, just come talk to me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I have nothing to hide. I can't shut up.
Yeah. So it's really funny that he sent them a, you know, I know that you know that I know that you know.
That is very funny.
Kind of thing.
That's very funny. And when will the documentary be released? When is the launch date?
The first episode comes out May 30th, and then every week after that. Okay, and then,
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations on it.
Thank you.
Really, it's a tremendous achievement. I can't imagine how – let me just ask. How many hours?
Oh. Well, you'll recall that Edward contacted me at the the end of 2019.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then I happened to go to Teddy right before the pandemic hit in January 2020. And then it was as a novice in narrative audio. I mean, I think this is the – what has made the experience both hell and joyous was having to learn how to do this. So when I got back from Billings and I'm like, oh, I have 4 hours of audio with him. What do I do with it?
Yeah.
And that was the biggest challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I mean, I also interviewed, 12 scholars, historians of the period from various angles and expertise. So then it was a process of how do I deal with like what Teddy has and these, quote unquote experts have, and what do I need to narrate, and what is the story I'm trying to tell? So,
right.
It was challenging, but it was rewarding because, when I think back to when I started to think about what do I do with this audio in the spring of 2020, where I was then and where I am now is totally different in terms of my understanding of how you do this narrative audio stuff.
Right. Well, the best way to learn something is to do it. The first time is painful.
Yeah.
But then you know how to do it. And, and what did you say the documentary you're working on now is?
So the next one I'm going to do after, I actually have a small project in between just because it's something I put on hold. I'll talk about that first. So, as I was saying a few minutes ago about the kind of lack of creative output at interview show, does.
Yeah.
I've been going back and forth about mixing up the format for the SRB podcast, which of course means doing more kind of more narrative stuff, but that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
So I came up with this idea. I think I came up with it looking for a way to not work on Teddy called Document, where, as Marshall, there's all these weird archival snippets or even newspaper weird stuff from Russian history.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of, you get some weird document and they do a podcast like narrative story about it.
Cool.
And the first one I want to do is Arch Getty, who I studied under at UCLA, for his Russian language exam, would give a KGB report about a piece of shit that someone sent that someone sent Stalin in the mail in 1935.
Yeah, high crimes.
and then how it like was analyzed, and the reports going, there's three documents about like the whole incident.
The shit.
Yeah. So I want to do a story about it's, and I already have a title. It's called A Gift for Stalin.
Yeah.
About this incident, but also like this, what is the role of feces in Russian Soviet society? Jokes about it. What to make of, what is this guy's intent of sending it to Stalin? A bunch of other stuff that I just want to do.
Sounds
something
fascinating.
Like, I just want to do something just ridiculous with it. And then the next project, the big one that I've been researching for 2 years on, I think maybe three now, is a multi-part series on African Americans, communism, and the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s, told through the life of a guy named Levitt Fort Whiteman. Who was the only African American we know of who was a victim of Stalin's terror. And basically that's going to explore how does this guy, who is born in Dallas, Texas in the 1890s, 1880, maybe 1880s. How does he end up in the Soviet Union?
Yeah, that's a good story.
And what is his role in participation in, the Communist Party in the United States, but also in the Comintern in the Soviet Union, and then in Soviet, and his life touched on so many big issues and people that this is what I want to explore.
I don't think people realize how closely, I mean, actually, if I recall correctly, in Invisible Man, Ellison, he has like extensive dealings with the Communist Party. If I recall correctly. Yeah. Yeah, he does.
Yeah. And Richard Wright.
Richard Wright, Paul Robeson, obvious and obvious.
Paul Robeson, of course.
And
Langston Hughes.
W.E.B. Du Bois.
That's right.
I mean, I don't think people realize.
I mean, Fort Whiteman wrote a letter to Du Bois when he was in the Soviet Union telling him out, like, you need to come check this place out.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Langston Hughes. So, I mean, just to speak about one connection Whiteman has, Langston Hughes goes to the Soviet Union in 1932 with about 20 other African-Americans to do a film. And Whiteman is a consultant on the film. The film collapses. The project collapses for a variety of reasons. But he's, you know, he's involved in that as well.
Yeah.
So
did any of the film survive, or is it just lost?
They never made it. They canceled it in production. Yeah.
That's
for
a tragedy.
There was a bunch of. It's still really unclear as to what the trigger was, but it seemed there's dissatisfaction and on all sides. Yeah. And then, you know, the main line is that the Soviet government decided to can it because they wanted diplomatic recognition from the United States.
Right.
And to make a film about American racism.
Yeah, that's
wasn't going to help them in those efforts.
Probably not a good idea. Yeah, especially then. That's good. All right. Well, thank you very much for spending time with us today. Let me tell everybody that we've been talking to Sean Guillory, who is the very successful academic podcast host. He hosts the SRB podcast. And as we said, he has a series coming out. What's the date again?
May 30th.
May 30th, and it is called Teddy Goes to the USSR. We'll put links in the blog post so you can subscribe to that. Sean, thanks for being on the show.
No, thanks for having me, Marshall.
Absolutely,
it's good to
my
talk.
Pleasure. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.